everybody, this is Hunt Tooley, and I am about to begin our Mises Academy course on World War I. So welcome to the course. It's good to see all of you here, and I hope the weather doesn't impact us too much, and good luck to those who are actually online with us and weathering the big storm in the Northeast as we speak. So we have a course here about the war, the crucible of the age of statism, and this is a subject that's very, very important for Misesians, very, very important for historical people who are interested in historical revisionism. It's very, very important for anarcho-capitalists and libertarians and alt-right, paleo, libertarian, right wing, whatever designation you happen to have. There's a great, there are so many great Mises quotations about World War I, and we'll see more than one of those in the course of this course. But one that I think is striking comes from Nation, State, and Economy in 1919. With the World War, mankind, he says, got into a crisis which nothing that happened before in history can be compared, with which nothing can be compared. In the world, the crisis whose beginning we are experiencing, and you remember he's saying this at the moment, at the moment of its ending. In the world crisis whose beginning we are experiencing, all the peoples of the world are involved. War has become more fearful because it is waged with all the means of the highly developed technique that the free economy has created. Never was the individual more tyrannized than since the outbreak of the World War, and especially of the World Revolution. One cannot escape the police and the administrative technique of the present day. And it's just fascinating that out of all of this vast confusion, and depend on it, Mises was in the midst of confusion in Vienna as the German Revolution had taken over Germany, defeat and revolution had taken over Austria. Every day it looked like the government would fall. The communists were in Hungary. It was mass chaos. The Bolsheviks were rolling all over Eastern Europe, and the thing that he emphasizes all this with, the thing that he points out, the sort of lesson he takes is one cannot escape the police and administrative techniques of the present day. Well, that is a fascinating comment, I think, and one that shows his prescience, and also that it gives us a way to think about the World War, because it was a war that just simply invented our era. It invented the 20th century. We can come down to moments of the war when we kind of think, well, this year, this 1916, it created our modern world. And I don't mean that in a good way, as they say. So this course, like the First World War, is supposed to be over by Christmas. I thought you'd like that. And here's how it will all be over by Christmas in our particular case. Tonight I want to talk about some causes of the war. Well, we'll talk about the course as well. We'll talk about the nuts and bolts a little bit. Danny has already made it pretty clear how the course works and all that, but we'll talk some more, and I'm trying to make sure I'm in good shape on the visual part of this, and the causes. Well, we'll discuss those, and I'll just talk about the causes when we begin. The second week we'll talk about a battle that or campaign that is often not quite, recognized, and by name in any case, and that is the Battle of the Frontiers. And it's what Europeans call the first phase of the war before stalemate set in. It's that time when the Schlieffen Plan went into effect, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, you will soon. It's that time when the war movement on the Western Front ceased. So we call it the Battle of the Frontiers. But all kinds of frontiers got crossed at that time. It's when this horrible new world began to appear as a kind of necessity to many European leaders. So the third time, talk about the broad subject from stalemate to stalemate. So from 1914 to 16 and the terrible battles of 1916. And there were many, the Somme, Verdun, Brusilov offensive in the east, Battle of Jutland on the sea, etc., etc. Also in Italy as well. In the fourth installment, we talk about imperial war, empires, and their enemies. And here I want to talk about not just the British and the French, but also the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Russian Empire. So this, in a sense, makes it a world war. And so I want to talk about these imperial connections in all sorts of ways, and I think they're very, very important for the explanation of the war. The fifth meeting will be about American entry and the Russian revolutions, all of which transformed the war. As René Albrecht Carrier, the great historian, 20th century European historian, used to say, this was the year that caused, in which the deeper forces broke through. In the sixth meeting, we'll talk about war finance. We talked to some extent about that in nearly every meeting, but we'll talk about war control. We'll read the famous Randolph Bourne essay and talk a little bit about him and his ideas and kind of apply those there. And in number seven, I took a line from Wilfred Owen, a phrase, Titanic Wars, and that's what we're looking at. I mean, as ferocious and as unprecedented as the battles of 1916 were, they were overshadowed by the battles of 1917, and those were overshadowed by the battles of 1918. It would have been impossible for the most pessimistic theorists of 1900 to imagine what that war would look like in the end. So that's what we'll talk about in that session. And then in the last one, conclusions. We won't spend all our time on the peace. That was one conclusion of the war, but there were other things. I want to talk about the costs of war. I want to talk about the physical scars of the war on the land. I want to talk about the creation of a new paradigm of state control, of how the war handed over. I mean, here we are with this storm on the east, and everybody knows what will happen to areas that get damaged. The government will push people away from their property, keep them out until it's everything is totally ruined or ransacked, and then they'll be allowed to go back in and apply for government insurance just so that the government has it all in its own hands. And everybody knows that will happen. We all know that will happen. Well, that was invented in World War I, too. That's sort of a French invention on the Western Front in the course of 1919 and 1920. So that's the course, and that's the way we'll do it. And I hope you enjoy it. Here's the way that I think it should proceed. This is all voluntary, and the customer comes first, and all that stuff. But here's how I'm just conceiving of this happening. You read the material ahead of time if possible. And some weeks I've kind of been a little heavy-handed. I mean, there's so much great stuff on this. I confess, on some weeks with the assignments, I just couldn't stop. It was almost compulsive. So I've put a lot of readings in there. I think they're very interesting readings. I wrote a book about World War One, and I'll explain that in a second. I've gotten that in there, and that's there. And I think it's pretty interesting. I mean, more or less. And so that's in there, and a lot of stuff from Ralph Rako and Hans Hoppe and Murray Rothbard and so forth. Plus some primary documents, plus some video, plus some songs. I mean, there's all kinds of things. There's some poems. But I think it would be best, I mean, ideally, you could read those before the lecture, and that way the lecture should make more sense. That's the theory of the, that's the theory of the thing. And Mises said you can't get too much of good theory. So there you have it. Feel free to write down questions as you're reading. And, I mean, if you're really gung-ho, just ask me, you know, just email me or Moodle me or whatever that's called. But also you can write them down and save them to ask with the whole class during the class session. So feel free to do however you like. each week, I will, in response to the readings and in connection with the readings, send out a question via Moodle to which you should write an essay if you want to grade for this whole course. I mean, if you're doing this, you want to do all the elements of the course and participate in that one. You write a response of at least 250 words. More is perfectly fine, I mean, as long as you want, really, but I'm thinking of something that's over more than just a page of reflection. So 250 words, and then I'll mark the essays and give them to you when, as best I can. The deadline for those essays is not absolute. I am embarrassed to say that a current member of the class had just recently contacted me to grade the last of her papers from a previous class. I name no names, but anyway, so I finally got around to that. I didn't know they were there. I forgot. But I will get to them, and if I haven't graded them, then you can just email me and say, why haven't you graded my paper? And that's the way that goes. So If you're not interested in having a grade for this, if you're not interested, I mean, you might want to do these essays anyway, just as a way of sort of responding to the reading or reflecting on it. Might be that you like structure like that and kind of a, you know, some kind of way to get into the material. It keeps you reading or keeps you thing or something, and that's perfectly fine. However you'd like to do it. So, but that's the way I'm thinking that will work. The class goes from 8:15 to 9:45 Eastern Time. You don't have to be here, as you know. I hope the number of attendees doesn't suddenly go down. You don't have to be here, and you even get to get up, you know, and go wherever, you know, put your toddler to bed or let the dog out or whatever. But the reason you can do this and still get the course is that the Mises Academy, as you know very well, has it all recorded, and you can listen to this thing and fast forward me as many times as you like. But that's perfectly fine, and I think you ought to make it work the way that it works best for you, the way that you can operate best with it. And if there's some, you know, if you've got some suggestion about, you know, me not looking at the camera often enough, or my Texas accent is too thick, or whatever you think, I mean, just email me. It's fine. I mean, I may not like it. I may yell at you, but what else can I do? So each class is generally going to be two sections, probably about half and half, probably maybe a little bit more lecture because there's an awful lot of material here that I would like to throw out in the course of this course. But we have a good long, as in the other classes, we'll have a good long question and answer, and I think those are really important, and they're really fun, and the more the merrier, and that's one great thing about attending live, that you just get to be a part of the discussion, and there's a lot of back and forth, and I really like that part. So, you know, in higher education, and I am in higher education, I teach at a liberal arts college in Texas called Austin College in Sherman, Texas. And in higher education, we really don't like this distance learning. And there's a good reason. I mean, it's a kind of threat. But, I mean, the party line at an institution such as this is that it's not nearly as good as a live professor in a classroom. And I suppose there are a lot of things that go on in the classroom that make it a very different and sometimes, you know, better environment for one reason or the other. And, of course, there are limitations to just looking at your computer and, you know, sitting there. But on the other hand, there's some things that we can do here that we can't do in a classroom. So I like it very much, and I enjoy teaching these courses very much. Okay, so we'll proceed in that way. Finally, how we will proceed. If you feel called to do so, be sure to go to the Moodle forum and discuss. Our course assistant Cam is an outstanding scholar himself and a good discusser. I know that because we're friends on Facebook, and we've had a few things around now and again. And so, we'll be around watching these discussions and thinking about, you know, the questions that you're throwing out there, or the comments that you're making, or the ideas that you have. Do get on that. I don't want there to be any compulsion about it. There's no requirement to do that. But if you feel like doing it, by all means, join in. I'll look in every now and then and, you know, throw in my two cents and all that. Please be polite. I'm sure I don't have to say that with this group, although one time we did have, Danny remembers this, we had an unpolite person on one of mine. I bet he's experienced more than one. But in any case, those are fun if you like that kind of thing. Let me, while I'm introducing the course, let me introduce myself. I am Hunt Tooley, and I do teach history at Austin College, as I mentioned. And I've been here since 91. I got my PhD at Virginia, and my field has always centered on the modern world, certainly. I've written a book about, my first book that came from my dissertation was about the eastern border of Germany, of the Polish border, and the plebiscites that happened after the first, just at the end of the First World War. And of course, I've written this little book called The Western Front, Battleground and Home Front in the First World War. And I've been interested in issues of ethnic cleansing and the state. I'm working now on a bigger work on the rise of brutality in the 20th century, and that's connected with my studies of World War I and so forth. In a little broader measure, I'm really interested in the Middle East. I've taught Middle Eastern history as a kind of sideline for years, and I've become more and more interested in applying the same kind of, I guess, revisionist or Misesian kind of view, a kind of praxeological view to the Middle East. So I've done a bit of writing in that and a lot of study in that area lately. So. Those are kind of my interests. The courses I teach here are modern Europe and a whole variety of courses that cover the last two or three centuries, and then in Europe and in the Middle East as well. Okay, well, look at this lineup. I mean, these are all prominent folks who helped start the war in some way, except perhaps Bismarck, who I put in there kind of hiding. behind a French prime minister and an Austrian prime minister. He may be the only one who didn't really start the war, although he did serve his purpose. Well, we have a difficult topic tonight, and the reason I say that is that when we talk about the causes of World War I, this of course has had reams and reams of material churned out about it. World War I used to be one of the largest single nonfiction things written about. The French Revolution, World War I, the Civil War, and then later, World War II happened, and of course then that was all flooded over. But the debate about the origins of World War I, which were of course very time-based in the 20s, they were very much attached to the way that the war ended, the way that the Paris peace set up the world. Many people thought for another war. Some people said there's going to be another war in 20 years, and in 20 years, exactly, there was. So these discussions went on and on and on. It's when revisionism first got its start, with Harry Elmer Barnes and a number of others writing books about the way that the American entry influenced the war and changed the course of events in such a material way, and then also how in order to set up a Europe, a new world, along the lines that Wilson and others were interested in, that Germany had to be vilified, had to be demonized in this way. And by the way, I think this is one of the real origins of the demonization of foreign leaders, Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein and all the rest. So we get the Kaiser as one of the first of these. It's true that goes back into history a little bit. The British pretty much demonized Napoleon. Maybe it's the British who are the pioneers here, but in any case, we picked up their pioneering spirit and demonized these people. So here are some of the folks who did it. They all wore business suits and uniforms, and that's an important thing. They all made these decisions. They were decision makers, and sometimes you get the idea that, as Paul Schrader wrote in a great article, that World War I was just galloping Gertie, that it all just happened and people threw up their hands and said, oh, I don't know, what can we do? But these guys could make decisions. I mean, they don't look like people who can't make decisions. You can make decisions, I can make decisions, and if we were to sit in a seat of power, we could say yes to war or no to war. Man in the corner, Earl Grey, Edward Grey, guy who's sitting easy in his wicker chair, he's the guy who made that comment about the lights going out in Europe. We can see the lights going out all over Europe. Well, they were going out because of his decisions, in part. So part of what Misesians internalize, I think, is that people do make decisions, and they sometimes those decisions are you know, wacky in our own view, but they do make a decision, yes or no, in those cases. I mean, in praxeology, kind of, in a sense, starts with that whole issue. Well, let's talk about some general issues here, some general sort of causes. The word cause is a difficult word. It really is. The longer I go, I guess I should say the longer I live, the longer I work in history, the harder it is to kind of pin down causes. You know, you get to the point where you can kind of, you know, see the point of this and see the point of that. And also you get to the point where you know more about those causes, and you know how somebody just perhaps asserted that something was the cause of some of their issues. So we have a lot of things that are asserted to be the cause of World War One or any other big historical event. And sometimes we have to qualify that a little bit or a lot. We have to think about whether it's just a sort of a distant influence or the actual causons that brings the thing on or whatever. But we'll talk about some issues here. The issues may be a better word than causes. And the issue in the beginning is the state system. There's a big alteration in the European state system in the 1860s up to 1871. And it started with the unification of Italy, which took place over about 3 or 4 years, ending up in 1862. Then Bismarck came to power in Germany right at that same time and sort of consciously copied the process through which Count Cavour had taken his country, Piedmont, to unify Italy around it. And so Bismarck, more or less on purpose, partly opportunistically but partly on purpose, caused three different wars, a war with Denmark along with Austria on his side, that was in 1864, and then a war with Austria, between Prussia and Austria. Bismarck was the prime minister of Prussia. And winning that and smashing Austria and changing it completely, pushing it out of the German world and pushing it toward the southeast and its own lands and its own sort of Austrian southeastern European empire. Then Bismarck managed to work up a war with France, and in all these wars the Prussians were using the technology that came, as Mises said in more than one place, from their freewheeling, very open economic system. They're very open, pretty free market system to win these wars. I mean, they were private companies making these weapons, not just the Krupps, the Dreyses were involved, and other companies, and so Bismarck managed to win these wars, and with each one he unified a little bit more. I won't go into it. The fact that I had to go through this in this case is a little bit like waving dope in front of an addict, because I like to talk about this a lot. But I'll pass by this and say in 1871 then, as Paris was surrounded by the Prussian and German army, and the armies of the other German states as well, then Bismarck engineered the announcement by the other German princes that they would join in and declare the King of Prussia also the emperor of the newly united country called Germany. Now, this country, Germany, had not been unified before ever. Not even in the Holy Roman Empire, after Christmas Day 800 when Charlemagne was crowned. And the reason I say that is that it was always just a kind of loose bundle of semi-sovereign units. And so it was never really, it was never a country in any sense, and nobody thought it was. There was always an independent Prussia, not always, but there were always different independent units. But it became unified for the first time in 1871, something that the old Germanic statesmen, the Austrians, let's say Metternich at the time of the Congress of Vienna, and his assistant Gentz, thought about a lot. And they said, we can't unify Germany because people will be so frightened of us, and we will be so aggressive. We get this huge big country together with all these people, big common culture, we're overachievers. We just throw ourselves at these tasks, and the next thing you know, we'll be invading our neighbors. That's what Gentz said in 1815. So there was a conscious decision on the part of German statesmen before that to maintain this kind of Germany that little smaller states negotiating with each other together in some kind of confederation. But it's big stuff in European history when you have a huge big chunk, and you can see it there on the little map on that slide. It's the kind of turquoise one in the middle, and then Austria-Hungary is still bigger, but it's less populated. It's the one just below that, and it juts way farther to the east, almost to the Black Sea. The only thing between Austria-Hungary and the Black Sea was a little bit of the Danubian states or the Danubian principalities, or what's today Romania. So there's that big, huge thing there that had just defeated France, just taken some chunks of France, just humiliated the emperor, captured him in battle. Terrible. So this is big stuff, and everybody's thinking about it. And, you know, it's a smaller thing that Italy is unified, but it's not the smallest thing. In other words, it's finally this country can gather all these resources, coordinate all of these things to gain military power. And as we're going to see, it's an age of nationalism. And, I mean, people in these big countries really had these aggressive feelings. So this is a big deal. This state system as a general world issue, it's a big deal. Bismarck, if you take one more look at that map, Bismarck after unified Germany said, okay, that's it, we've done three wars, that's all we're gonna do. I'm a big peacemaker now, and it's our role in Europe to always play the peacemaker because we don't want any more wars. And the way we're going to do this is that we're going to keep France isolated no matter what. No matter what else happens in European politics, we're going to keep France alone. And so Bismarck's whole diplomacy was surrounding this one thing. And so he made an alliance first to get the Austrians back in good graces and got the Austrians in alliance. And then he made an alliance with the Russians to make sure that they would still be on his side. And then he was friendly with Britain and had a lot of sort of semi-free trade agreements with Britain. And then you see what I mean. So he makes friends with everybody except France and leaves France looking for friends. Okay? So this is a key point here that we'll follow up on in just a moment. Another thing that happens as a result of these, isn't there a little pointer hand here? Oh, yeah, there it is. It's not a hand, it's just an arrow, so everybody can see that, right? Another thing that happens is that Austria and Hungary went through, in 1867, a huge reconfiguration of power. Previously, Vienna, the capital right there, had ruled over the whole thing, and there was a separate kingdom of Hungary, but it was pretty much interlaced. After 1867, a new regime came about. It was called the Compromise or Ausgleich, and Austria became the Austrian Empire became at that time Austria-Hungary. So it became two really autonomous pieces, and the Hungarian Parliament gained more power, and they were linked together through finance ministries. There was an imperial finance ministry, an imperial defense ministry. But pretty much, but then there were separate finance ministries in both places. And so there was a separateness there. And this exacerbated the problems of nationality, because this was a huge multinational empire in which really dozens and dozens and dozens of languages were spoken, in which the Austrians, the German Austrians, and the ruling house was the Habsburg house. They had done a quite amazing job keeping the whole thing together. They did it by sort of a soft touch, by making sure that the next generation of their family always married the right people to get in the right positions to be the owners of a given state or province or whatever, and then by negotiating by saying to folks, you know, you have some say in this too, and you decide local issues. I mean, this is why Mises, of course, why his family was so honored. I mean, they were out on the periphery of the Austrian Empire over in Galicia. And I'm pointing there now. But they were part of a continual negotiation within this empire. So the fact that the Hungarians took over and were more heavy-handed nationalists, that made a big deal too, because that made many more problems with a newly emerging old country that had been a kingdom years and years before. That was Serbia, which is right there. You'll see it closer in a little bit, but that's what I mean by these state system issues. So I spent a long time on that slide, but it'll go faster now. There are other general world issues that are the background to war for certain. And one is the new imperialism. So after 1871, you could argue after 1865, 67, after the opening of the canal in 1869, the Suez Canal, then this outburst of European imperialism happened. Of course, the British and French already had empires, and Portuguese, Spain. But on the other hand, a new kind of imperialism happened, one where planting the flag became more the issue, one that was much more abrasive and hard-edged and power-related and state-related even than the others had been. And so many contemporaries, including the famous J.A. Hobson, called this the new imperialism, a new kind. And so it's the kind of things where Cecil Rhodes, as you see, is astride Africa, but it's Africa, you know, hooked together with from north to south by the British Empire. The scramble for Africa occurred roughly from the 1880s on. All of it was gobbled up except Ethiopia. Southeast Asia was all snapped up by the French or the British. India expanded on its edges. Russians moved west and south and clashed with the British in the great game in Central Asia. You get the picture. This was all happening at one time, and it led to many actual clashes between these European countries. In reality, though, it didn't bring on the war. I mean, it was a Balkan issue that brought on the war, and indeed, the alliance system largely came about because the powers were able to negotiate on these imperial issues. Give you just a quick example, and the main example is that the Russians, the French, and the British got together when they were able to, and nearly with the war in the Sudan, nearly with the war in a place called Fashoda, and then and they decided, well, that wasn't so fun, and so they called off their troops, sat down at a table, and just swapped these colonial places. Okay, you take Egypt, we'll take Tunisia. You take this, we'll take that. And that's the beginning. That's the beginning of the Entente, the E-N-T-E-N-T-E, the Entente Cordiale between Britain and France. And so that's a part of it. And then a few years later, 1907, the British and the Russians did the same thing, and they divided up Persia and divided up some other places and said, okay, well, we've settled our differences. So this is important. One reason it is that imperial is so important is that it does two things. It engages many more Europeans in brutality abroad, and this is major league brutality, the genocidal kind of brutality in many cases, in with the Hereros, the Germans wiping them out. The Americans wiping out big areas in the Islamic part of the Philippines, the Cubans inventing the concentration camp, all those things. And so it does bring a lot, did I say Cubans? I meant the Spaniards inventing concentration camps in Cuba. But all these blowback things happened to them in the same way that they're happening to us now. In other words, they were brutal there, and they came back home, and they were brutal at home, too. So there's a new air of brutality in Europe, and that's really crucial. That's really crucial here. There's also a lot of detailed reasoning about who is an enemy, because off in the bush they wanted to define enemy. So there's a lot of talk about who's an enemy and who can be shot at sight and all that stuff. And so these discussions, and it's too much of a separate topic to go into right now, but these discussions are crucial to the new imperialism. And so all of these imperial issues condition the Europeans, although the empire itself is clearly not the imperial clashes are not the beginning of this war at all. So we have that. We have the issue of nationalism, and I need to spend just a moment on that. Many of you know this. Actually, those who were in the previous course know this already for sure. That the European program of nationalism, and there are some great, great passages in Mises' book Omnipotent Government, in his book Nationalism as well, Nation State and Economy. He wrote a lot about this topic. And essentially, this is a little equation I used, but I stole it from Mises. It basically, nationalists in the 19th century wanted to make their state correspond to their nation. Nation being the people they were born into a relationship with, right? The Latin word natio, at the root of nation. And so they're born into that relationship. That is, their ethnic confreres or brothers and sisters or whatever. And so they're born into this relationship, and only in this relationship, all clumped together, can they fulfill the task of history, whatever the heck that means. So they thought that their life would be better, that Europe would be better, that the world would be better if they made their nation correspond to their state and their state correspond only to their nation. In other words, get a state drawn where all the Magyars or Hungarians were within the same border. Or get a state drawn where all Frenchmen were within the same border or whatever. So that's the nationalist program. There are plenty of other aspects. There's you know, whole big discussions about national culture and what makes Hungarianness and how history comes into it, and all these are fruitful. But the core idea here is to make your nation your state and your state your nation. And so this was very, very disruptive in European affairs. And after the addition of Darwinism, of social Darwinism in the 1870s, I see, and I think Carlton Hayes and many other historians of this period have seen a very direct shift to an almost biological ethnicism or nationalism, where the other guys are not just a different group who sing different Christmas songs and do different things on Easter. They are people who are dirty. They're people who are dangerous. They're people who are ignorant. They're people who are less. So anyway, there's a big change, I think, that happens in the 1880s, and it happens in the midst of the new imperialism, and I think it's playing off that, and I think it's involved in that too, pushing the imperialism too. So nationalism is a pretty important issue here. In a way, nationalism did start the war. If you really push it and crank it up and say, well, the Serbians were nationalists because they wanted to do this, it was more of a scheme than an idea. But if you wanted to make that case, I think you could make it better than the imperialism case. Then there are cultural trends that are backing up this whole thing. I mentioned social Darwinism. It's this interpretation, this popularization of Darwinism that really leads to this sort of survival of the fittest, but we interpret that sort of negatively. We want to make sure there are many times where social Darwinists had many, many positive things that they wanted to contribute, and they wanted to uplift the lower races, and as an American president said, uplift our little brown brothers in the Philippines and things like that. But then there's this hard-edged side to it that promoted both nationalism and empire at the same time. And so that was part of the rising brutality. It's that the weak, you know, you're not doing them any favor if you let them survive. And this was the attitude of the Germans coming into France and Belgium in 1914. It was the attitude of the Russians coming into the Eastern Germany at the same time. The attitude of all these armies. Hey, we're not doing them any favors if we let them weak. So there is this social Darwinism. Socialism was, of course, on the rise. And let me add, just to throw in positivism with that. Of course, Auguste Comte was not a Marxist in any sense, but he was certainly related in the kind of top-down quality of his political plans and political theory. And indeed, I think Marxists and positivists have gotten along in many cases pretty well. But positivism is of course this doctrine that the state to be run correctly has to be run by experts. It's an outgrowth of Saint-Simon's ideas about technocracy, as I'm sure many of you know all about. And Comte just took it one step further and said, well, what we need is a society where we don't have parliaments and silly things like that, people debating about where to put the roads and these kinds of things. But rather we need experts who know where the roads should go. They know how people should live. And then there's a problem of keeping people from killing each other, and you do that by making a civic culture, and you have churches, well, not churches really, but they're churches of the state, of the civic whole of ourselves, and they, in Comte's descriptions, they look just like churches, but there are no crosses, there's no Christianity, but people would get together and sing songs about how they love their brothers and sisters in their civic world and all that stuff. So this kind of thing went well with socialism, went well with nationalism too. In fact, all of these ideas, you'll notice, were collectivist. I mean, these waves of collectivist doctrines washed over what was essentially a liberal Europe in the middle of the century. Nationalism, socialism, social Darwinism, positivism, all of that. And liberalism just didn't survive it. I mean, it survived in little nooks and crannies, and thank goodness for that. Another of these trends, I thought earlier today about how to express that, and I ended up calling it Belle Époque Ennui. I don't know if that has any meaning or not, but there is a sense, and you see this in a lot of the memoirs of upper class people at the time, that people were just pretty bored. They just that the free society of the 19th century had created a high culture and art and civilization, and a lot of people just kind of suffered from an ennui in the midst of that. This led also to a number of schools of thought, like there's a generational school of thought. This is the subject of a wonderful book by Robert Wohl, W-O-H-L, called The Generation of 1914. It's about 30 years old, but it's a fine book. And he discusses this whole sense of people, but just before World War I, thinking, well, our society, we have to break free. Nietzsche tells us to break free of the bonds of constraints, and it's our generation that has to do this. So there's a kind of generational thinking, and Wohl attributes a lot of the willingness of people to go join up in such droves, especially the intellectuals in 1914, to this kind of generational thinking. There was a fatalism to it, and this was connected both with this Belle Époque, and we call the period the Belle Époque, this before World War I. It was such a beautiful world, and it really was. One of the ways in which these are hooked together is fatalism as well. There's a whole kind of dark fatalistic edge. In, for example, the commander-in-chief of the German army in 1914, the man who was going to carry the Schlieffen Plan out. And there's this whole kind of sense that, you know, it is a leap in the dark for him, and he doesn't know if they're going to make it or not, and he's really not sure of anything, and maybe it'll all just end in one big final battle, and may the best Darwinian man win, and all of that. There's a whole lot of fatalism there, which is connected, then again, to this discovery of the subconscious. I mean, Freud really hit a nerve at precisely this time, when his first publications were 20 years before the war, and this idea that there is a subconscious part, that it's not a rational society, that we don't necessarily make all rational decisions and all that. This is really, it popularized Freud, I should say, in the same way as popularized Darwin, is sort of a part of this picture. And then finally we get folks like the left anarcho-syndicalist Georges Sorel, first name George, who wrote in his famous book Reflections on Violence that you know, why are people afraid of violence? Violence is cleansing. Violence is good. He extolled it in the same way that violence had been extolled by in the various Slavic groups that started these violent trends in the 1870s and 1880s. So there's a lot of cultural trends backing up this war and its origins. Let me just whip through some actual specific causes, and we'll see. I mean, we'll see how they fit into all these other molds. One of these is the Franco-Russian alliance, which is just crucial in all this. It's absolutely crucial. Remember, I said that Bismarck had kept France isolated, and he did a good job of it. This is oftentimes you read in textbooks and you hear historians say, "Well, the alliance system caused World War I." Not Bismarck's alliance system. Bismarck's alliance system kept everybody peaceful as long as he ran it with his extreme skill. Everything was fine. What happened was that his old emperor, the Kaiser Wilhelm I, died. His son came to the throne and about the same time learned that he had throat cancer and died only a year or so later. And then his son, the 31-year-old Wilhelm II, that's the Kaiser, you know, the one we all love to hate, he came to the throne as a fairly young man, a bit of an odd character, intelligent, but never knew when to stop talking, and he hated Bismarck. The younger one hated Bismarck. And so eventually he managed to get Bismarck to tender his resignation, and to Bismarck's great surprise, the young man accepted it. So Bismarck's gone. He's the one who's kept the Russians happy, France isolated, the Austrians happy, all this in place. And then the new Kaiser decides that why do we need Russia anyway? So there had been a reinsurance treaty that was a treaty with a limit on it. That limit was 1890. And when he resigned, the Russians were already in Berlin to negotiate, and this treaty was called the reinsurance treaty. It involved shipping, it involved a defensive military alliance and then shipping some goods, swapping some finished goods for some raw materials. But Bismarck left office, the Kaiser and the diplomats talked, and they said, "Nah, why bother?" And so they dropped this reinsurance treaty, which scared the Russians to death because then they were isolated. They looked around Europe and said, "Well, you know, we don't like Republicans since we're the autocrats of Europe, but in this case, we got to do it." So they went to the French, and there was this courtship of a couple of years where the Tsar received the French deputation coming to talk to him, and it stood bareheaded while they played the Marseillaise, which was this ironic thing. And then the same thing in reverse in Toulon. where the Tsar visited France. So one thing and another, and in 1892 the Franco-Russian alliance occurred. There's a key financial point to this, and it's the first of our big financial points, but this one's really, and this one, like all of them, are really important. Part of the deal was that Russia, and this is now the Russia of Alexander III, hence, by the way, the Alexander III Bridge, which is possibly my favorite structure in the entire world. It's certainly in my top three in Paris. It's if you've been to Paris, you've seen it. It's this absolutely gorgeous bridge, and you may have wondered why it was called the Alexander III Bridge, because they tell you on those bateau cruises that go under it, but as you go under the bridge, they never quite get it out. Oh, the speaker always goes, they always say, well, the reason this bridge has been built is because blah, 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 and then you come out on the other side of the bridge. But the real reason is it was a cementing of this Franco-Russian alliance, and so they call this gorgeous bridge the Alexander III Bridge, and there's an image of it on it and everything. So they get together. The Russians need capital to – the Russians have no middle class, right, to speak of. They don't have anybody gathering capital to invest. They have a – the nobility is largely impoverished except the very richest, and they think it's crass to get involved for the most part in industry. And so the Russian government has a scheme that goes back to the 70s that's about state investment, heavily state investments in Russia, which is no big surprise. That kind of fits a part of the Russian mold. And so the Russians want to do this state investment and catch up in terms of industrial might. I mean, they were way behind. Russia was extremely backward technologically and industrial. They didn't have anywhere to get the capital, but part of the Franco-Russian alliance was the Russians got the French to agree to float a series of huge bond issues on the French bond market. So this booming, growing, huge, bustling, saving middle class in France, and remember, it is a time you can save. The gold standard's in effect. I mean, you can really save, and you know what you're saving, and you know exactly what you've got. There's no danger there. So they're floating these big loans on the French market, and people are buying these things like crazy. So in effect, this became the biggest debt issue in Europe all of a sudden, so that the French middle class had to see Russia succeed. They wanted Russia to succeed. And so when war came in 1914, is the middle class likely in this case to say, no, let Russia go it alone, let Russia fight Germany, we don't want anything to do with that? No, they were all in saying, save Russia, save our investment here. So that's the first sort of financial edge to all this, and I think it's an interesting one. Russians are now aligned with the French. I'm trying to get this little arrow off because it's. I'll use it again here in a second. This follows in train. The Schlieffen Plan is an exact outgrowth of the Franco-Russian alliance. I mean, it happens immediately. At least the planning does. Look here, here's Germany, and over here, just sort of by Schlieffen's nose, that's where Russia starts. So now that Russia over in this neck of the woods is aligned with France over here, then Germany's got a huge big enemy on both sides. One, a booming country, 30 million people, 25 million people, highly industrialized, second leading industrial country in Europe, and or third anyway. And so then on the other side, this massive producer of people and raw materials. So it's a very, very dangerous situation. So it's still under the Kaiser's call, and he okays the army to bring in as chief of staff this guy Alfred von Schlieffen, whom you see before you, and they tell him to create a plan that will take care of this two-front war should it ever occur. And that plan, it gets knocked together pretty fast, but then changed and altered and everything. By 1905, it's pretty much ready. This is an early version of the plan. I got this cool picture. It is an early version because in this plan, they're actually crossing across right through the city of Maastricht here in the Netherlands. And that was just the first version. Eventually, they said, well, you know, politically, we're going to violate the neutrality of one neutral. Why do it to two? And so they narrowed that. But on the other hand, this was tricky because it lessened the width of the road through which they would go through Belgium and enter Belgium, at least in the most rapid wing, to just this little bit. It's just really 15 miles or so wide. As an army, that last army, the German Fifth Army there, which eventually would be led by a general named von Kluck, that army was about 185,000 men and all the stuff and all the wagons and trains and all that. So they needed a big, you know, they couldn't, they weren't on one road. I mean, they needed a huge, big swath to go through. And so that was significant. But in any case, the idea was one kind of holds on here, doesn't move very much. One kind of holds on here. The fifth army goes the farthest and swings way around to the west of Paris. And then here on the upper Seine and on the Marne River, here they crush the French army. And then after this army is crushed, then they go to the east because everybody figured the Russians couldn't mobilize within 6 weeks. So they figure we got like 4 weeks to do this, 5 weeks maybe, then everybody gets on a train and goes to Russia. That's the Schlieffen plan. 1905 is the first, the first edition is earlier. By 1905 it was in different hands and changed a little bit, but that's pretty much the shape of it. And I need to move ahead because we need to have our Q&A. There are other aggressive designs around. The reason they knew that the French army would be right here is because the French plan 17 involved a French invasion deep into Germany at that point. So the French had their aggressive plan too, and so did other powers. The French and British were getting together for military talks after 1905, 1906. There were other. I mean, take the Serbian secret terror war against Austria-Hungary that lasted for a number of years, of which the assassination of the Archduke was only the last straw. That was pretty aggressive, too. There were other aggressive things going on. The Russian pogroms driving Jews into Central Europe. Carlton J. H. Hayes, a wonderful historian, I recommend him to you, wrote in a pearl of a book called A Generation of Materialism, 1941. And his summary is that I would summarize his comment as this: in the wake of 1871, power just came to prevail in principle all over Europe, an aggressive power in many, many ways. Let me say just a word about Austria-Hungary and then a word about the Balkans and then we're done. I've mentioned already the problems of Austria-Hungary, and you see its position between Germany and Poland is actually Russia. There's no Poland at this point. So this is Russia here, Russia here, Russia here, then Romania here. It's got this border with Serbia, on the Hungarian side. Move over here. It's got a border with Croatia. Croatia is within Austria-Hungary, and it's got a border. After it took Bosnia, then it had this and had a border with Montenegro. Bordered on Italy over here, Switzerland, Germany, and so forth. So it's got a lot of borders to protect and to act upon and to keep up with. But it's got all these nationalities there too. And I think I've already talked enough about the extent to which the Austro-Hungarians were a kind of a negotiated state. But they eventually came to see Serbia as this real pest state, which kept on infiltrating propagandists into Austro-Hungarian territory. And the Serbian state was a very neo-mercantilist little state, and they would cut off the sale of pigs at a given time, and cut off this and cut off that. And so it was not a happy relationship even before the assassination of the Archduke. There were also then family problems within the Habsburg family, which was usually the family that strategized the best of any family ruling in European history. On the right is Franz Josef, who became the emperor of the Austrian Empire in 1848 and died in 1916. And was a witness to much family tragedy and trouble in his time. His son committed murder-suicide with his mistress, and his wife was assassinated, and all kinds of things happened. And one thing that this all led to was that his nephew, whom he really hated cordially, became the heir to the throne. That's the Archduke Prince Ferdinand with his family. And, of course, the family was not going to be in any way related to the throne because Franz Josef made sure that the right documents were signed so that when he came to the throne, she was excluded. Sophie she was not even to appear with him when he appeared in his capacity as Archduke of Austria. So there was this squabble, and this made things worse when it came to a head. And we'll talk next week about the assassination and the outbreak of the war. But that's the way that works. In the Balkans here again, and just to get your map set before you do this other reading, Serbia in the middle, Greece is here, and before 1912, 1913, and the two sets of Balkan wars. This map, which is actually from 1910, I really love this map. It's just a couple years too early for us. But there was a war in which these countries, Bulgaria, Greece, and Serbia, and Albania eventually, which didn't even exist in this picture, took over, gobbled up the remaining part of Balkan Turkey here, except for just a very little bit over on this side of Istanbul. And so that was all gobbled up in two wars. So, I mean, one historian, a great historian, Joachim Remak, said that there were two Balkan wars, one in 1912, one in 1913, and then there's a third one, too, and we just called that World War I. But it certainly did start as a third Balkan war. So you have all these great, huge causes, but, you know, it's not quite clear how they all work since there was just this one state that was financing terrorism in this part of Austria-Hungary, which had been only owned by them for a few years. So next time the explosions. One thing I want to say here, and just to summarize all these causes, I'm sure it's already occurred to all of you how many are related to the state. In other words, all of these are collectivist, statist kinds of doctrines, nationalism and socialism and positivism, and even the varieties of social Darwinism that were at work in these instances. So everything's about the collective, and all these collectives turn out to be state-enhancing. The governments were getting bigger. They were just waiting for this Higgsian crisis, the Robert Higgs-style crisis, to grow much bigger. But we'll talk more about that next time. So I've eaten into our question and answer time a little, but I do have we do have some time left. So I would say let us have at it. If you have questions or comments, this is the time to do it and to ask those or put those. I'd say go to it. Kathy asks, can you recommend a biography of Bismarck, please? You know, there are several. There's a I'm going to I'd almost say the name. The one by Edward Crankshaw is pretty good, and also the one by the American historian. I'll say his name in a second. I thought I might be able to see it in the bibliography. I'll think of it, Kathy. Don't worry. Never fear. I'll think of it. Yeah. FYI, Malcolm says, several of us would love for you to teach a course on Middle Eastern history from a Misesian perspective, since you can specialize in that as well. That would indeed be fun. That would be great. Yeah. Yeah, I would love that. We use Mustafa Eichhoff's book and some other stuff. That would be really fun. I've become really, really interested in Turkey, and I've taken students there. At our college, we have a January term, and so we're able to travel as a part of a course a lot. And so I've been to Turkey quite a few times with the students, it's a great place in many ways. So fascinating. So yeah, I would love to do that, Malcolm. By the way, are you any kin to the great composer Malcolm Arnold? Well, he asked me a question at the same time. Could you speak a little more about about social Darwinism and how that was spreading and how that related to politics, economics, and war? Yeah, I mean, social Darwinism is more, in a way, it's a little bit inaccurate to suggest that all of social Darwinism is a part of the problem. Basically, there are some people who say this. Okay, well, there are winners and losers in the game of life, and the issue is not survival of the fittest, but the fact that we understand that some people are inferior and some people are behind and some people haven't developed over time the abilities and the civilization and all that. And so we need to help those people. Now, that's not really problematic if you're just going to help people, okay? On the other hand, in some cases, the individuals who went to help then call down their governments to come help too, and that was problematic. There's a couple of famous letters that we use in history as documentary sources for imperialism, where these two well-intentioned preachers. Now, these are not social Darwinists; they are just missionaries, and they're saying, "Boy, you know, if the government could just come and take over these islands, that's all these people need." Is for empire to come here and take them, and we would do them a world of good, and that way we could build school, and that way we could make them go to school, and that way we could, you know, make them work because they're all so lazy and everything, and they just live these lives not working hard, and so anyway, that kind of thing is not useful. But the social Darwinism that's really about that takes the other tack. Okay, these people are inferior. It's sort of the heart of darkness, social Darwinism, where they're inferior and you just have to kill all the brutes. You know, that's the kind that's rough. I mean, you know, these folks were, many of these imperial peoples were just treated badly, and some of them were treated absolutely horribly. Americans, you don't have to read very far into the Philippine, our Philippine wars to see these atrocities committed against people, and you know, they're just the torturing and the water torture. They didn't even waterboard; they just poured the water right in people and then smashed their stomachs, and often, you know, just it damaged people permanently or killed them. And so, anyway, it's this sense of the little brown brothers and marching in to protect them, that's it. I think a lot, some social Darwinists were rigid free market people, and I think that some social Darwinists then reasoned, especially the ones who folded their social Darwinism into positivism. And I've got a book for you on that that shows exactly how that was done. That's a book by Gillis Harp, H-A-R-P, an old grad school pal of mine who wrote a great book on American positivism. And I think if you're interested in that, you'll find that very interesting, how they put those two together. So Gillis Harp, and I don't remember the name of the book, but just look him up on Amazon. You can find the name of that book. There's something about positivism in the title. Nathan Hayes says, what was the main medium of state propagandizing prior to the war that led to nationalism, or did it come from other sources? That's an excellent question, really good question. States did indeed nationalize, and we have to go case to case here, I think. But I would say, if I consider everything, I would say that the main method of propagandizing was hands down public schooling. The premier case here is France, and under a person who later became the prime minister, Jules Ferry, F-E-R-R-Y, he was the minister of culture, or minister which also included education in the 70s and 80s. And he had a survey done to see how French everybody in the country was, how much they were aware of their Frenchness and aware of the grandeur of France. And he and his people in the culture ministry read the reports, and they were absolutely shocked. He said, you know, there are people down on the Massif Central, down in central and southern France. There are people there who don't even know they're French. That you ask them who they are, and they say, well, I'm a peasant of this region. I'm a Christian. I mean, what do you want? I'm a person of this in my village. When the answer was supposed to be, I'm a proud Frenchman, right? And so Ferry said, we have to take these peasants and turn them into Frenchmen. That's our goal. And so this is the main tool. To some extent, that's the case with Germany. They retooled the schools to make sure that their own country got the main play, that everybody knew about the grandeur of France, that they all studied the same day and the same kinds of things. So that was pretty important in Europe. The governments didn't have the control of the press They didn't have the kind of influence on the press and relationship with the press that sometimes has occurred since then. So that's an important way. I'd say that's the most important way. Let's see. Yes, Malcolm, I Cam, if you can write this down too, make sure I do it. Or Malcolm, if I don't send these out or put them out on the site, then just email me or something, or Moodle me. I think there's a Moodle way of communicating, right? And so that's the imperialism. Okay, yeah, I'll gladly put that link up. No problem. Let's see. Malcolm also says, have you studied how anthropology departments in academia were being used in propagating social Darwinism and war efforts? If so, can you give your views? I have done some reading. I mean, it's not enough to comment on. It's been a while, but yeah, for sure. I mean, and again, social Darwinism has so many branches. It's got the birth control branch. I mean, Margaret Sanger was a wild social Darwinist who wanted, I mean, she introduced birth control so the lower classes wouldn't propagate. I mean, and this is quite clear if you just read a few of her books. There's that kind of thing. So it was in all kinds of different areas, yeah. Eric, and I'm gonna say Abravanel says, the Empress of Austria-Hungary, what role did she play and what did she accomplish as a woman surrounded by all these men running around? Oh, you mean Maria Theresia? Well, she was a pretty good queen. She was a pretty good empress. But she lived in the 18th century, in the middle of the 18th century, and held the whole thing together. I think she had good sense. I think she was a person who was, I mean, she was an enlightened despot. I mean, she believed that the house had full power over everything and owned everything. But for that reason, she wanted everything to go well. I mean, this is Hans Hoppe's argument about the state. If you're going to have a state, you might as well have a monarch, because that way they own it and they take care of it. And so I'm oversimplifying Hans's thesis there, but that's the case. I mean, she took good care of it, and she did consider herself not just a high and mighty, goddess over everybody, but rather the first servant of the state. And so she was kind of autocratic, but many of the things she did were sort of proto-liberal. And the approach of the Habsburgs was always proto-liberal. In fact, she's telling Marie Antoinette, you know, who was her daughter and the married the King of France, she's telling her, look, in letters, look, you're just not going the Habsburg way here. You're not the people you're dealing with, you're not negotiating with. We use a softer touch. And so that's the type of person she was. So yeah, I on the whole, I'd give her B+. Kathy Cuthbert says, what was Ferry's attitude and outgrowth of the revolution or Napoleon or what? I think Jules Ferry was a, here's what happened to French liberals and German liberals and all kinds of liberals. In the 1860s and 1870s, at the crest of the wave, Europe was a liberal place from the 1830s to the 1850s, Central and Western Europe, by and large. It's a big generalization, but by and large, it was a very liberal place in the sense that they had a very free market, and the governments were extremely limited in their capacities to harm people and their willingness to harm people and all that. So at the crest of that wave, then comes all of this nationalizing. It begins in 1848 and rolls on to the 50s, and then Italy gets unified and that kind of thing. And in each of these countries, the liberal parties split in every single one. In France, it split into several pieces. In Germany, it split into two pieces, but it's the same kind of split. And the split was the same kind of split that you'd think of today in conservative / libertarian terms. The liberals, the kind of people for example, that Ralph Rako has written so much about, this German parliamentarian, a real hero of a kind of Ron Paul before his times, whose name was Richter, and his party remained true to principle in Germany in 1867, and the rest of them went off and said, well, we're national liberals. We're national liberals with the emphasis on the nation in national liberals. And so they wanted to be big, and they wanted to be Hamiltonian and all of that stuff. And the same thing happened in France, though, again, the party system was more complex. But basically, Ferry was one of these national liberals. In Britain, the Liberal Party split into imperializing. They were called Union Liberals, but they were about the people who liberals, but they liked the empire, whereas the old Gladstone Party were liberals and they hated the empire. So everywhere that split in the 1860s and 70s and crashed apart. So that's what happened to old liberalism. There's a little different trajectory in Austria, where there are all these liberal folks in, when in fact members of the Austrian school, the original Austrian school, were influential. But that was swept away under the waves of nationalism and neo-mercantilism at the end of the century. I hope that answers your question. That's a really good question. Malcolm says, I have a couple of questions in the chat window. We put questions that tend to be longer there because Q&A max length is shorter. Okay, let me look. Let me take a look. Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to keep track of this window. I've got to figure out a way to do that. Oh, thank you, Cam, for putting Gillis's book up there. Let's see. Carl says, I'll just go from the bottom up. Was Serbia a limited monarchy? Well, Serbia was in theory, it was limited monarchy because it had a parliament and a constitution and, you know, prime minister and all the apparatus of that. In fact, the king's power really was, now that I think of it, it really was limited. The monarchy, many of those dynamics had changed in the Serbian monarchy because in 1903 there was a vicious palace revolution in which the old ruling family was thrown out quite literally because the old king, a bunch of officers in the name of the new dynasty went up and chopped him into three small pieces and threw him out the window. But there was a big change in 1903, which is what I sometimes think is ironic about the Serbians protesting in 1914 that they couldn't let the Austrians come in and investigate the crime because it would be an abrogation of their constitution. In fact, it was a kind of wild and woolly type of system. But yeah, I mean it was authoritarian like every other monarchy in theory and in functionality, probably just normal levels of corruption. So that's what I'd say to that. Let me see, other questions. Let's see. The British and the French, Leslie says, the British and the French have fought for hundreds of years. Why in the 19th century did the British suddenly become close to the French and antagonistic to the Germans? It is true that the British fought, but only off and on for those hundreds of years, Leslie. I mean, in America, we've made a bigger deal of that 18th century episode, whereas in the 17th century, they were not fighting together, and then in previous centuries, they were. So it was always kind of off and on. And after the defeat of Napoleon in 1815, then the French were brought in because of some very clever diplomacy and because there were people who wanted to make real peace. The French were brought into the Quadruple Alliance, and it was made the Quintuple Alliance, and the French became basically allies of the British. And after 1815, there was no time at which the British were about to go to war with France, and indeed, they cooperated on many things, including being allies in the huge Crimean War against the Russians in the early 1850s. So the British and the French had buried the hatchet pretty definitely in 1815. So it was that you're right, it's kind of, it's sudden since the British had fought them for the previous 50 or 60 or 70 years, but the sudden thing was the end of the Napoleonic Wars, defeat of Napoleon, Congress of Vienna, 1815. Let's see. John Anderson says, both Germany and France had elaborate operational plans that depended on how it worked on, that they depended on should war break out. Sorry. How correct is it to assume that once mobilization orders were issued, they could not be stopped? John, that's a wonderful question. And I'll tell you this. It varied from army to army, but the Germans felt like the commander felt like they couldn't be stopped. And I know that because this happened. The Moltke was in a schoolhouse in Luxembourg commanding what was about to be the start of the Schlieffen attack. This is on August 2nd, 1914. the Kaiser, whom we all love to hate, came to that schoolhouse and walked in, the king, to this general and said, "Mr. Moltke, what's our plan?" And he said, "Well, we have to invade France in order to, because the Russians are invading us." And he said, "I don't understand." He said, "I know that you have a plan, but it's just the Russians are invading, it's not the French." And Moltke said, "Well, you know, that's the way it goes. This is the plan." And he said, "Don't you have another plan?" He said, "Well, not really. This is the plan." And so the Kaiser, in fact, unknowingly, he made a very ugly remark. He said, "Your uncle would have given me another answer." That was his great uncle who won the Franco-Prussian War. And apparently this set Moltke off on his first nervous breakdown. He had like two or three nervous breakdowns in the crucial part of the Schlieffen plan. And this can't be good for the commander to behave that way. But in any case, I'll give you that example, that concrete example to answer that question. Moltke thought it couldn't be. I think they can always be revised, but if the people in charge of them aren't willing to do it or keep on telling everybody outside the planning sphere, I mean, this is the way the state works. You know, these little kingdoms and bailiwicks and turfs and everything, and people always get dug in and tell the ones on the outside. It's like the FBI telling people you can't do this any other way, or the CIA doing that. So, yeah, that's a good question. Where are more? Cam, can you see more questions up here that I haven't answered? I should have been watching this the whole time. And I think we're nearly out of time. I'll be glad to answer a few more questions. Let me shift back to the Q&A. And don't let me skip any questions, okay? Make sure that you bring those to my attention. Okay. So Nathan, then, on the Q&A line list has a question here. How was a nation as large and backward as Russia able to be cohesive enough to commit war as one nation? Did all Russians identify themselves as Russian? Oh, no, I don't think they did, Nathan. And Russia had even more nationalities than British, than the Austro-Hungarians. There were unifying factors. I mean, there had been this pan-Slavist Russification of many of the borderlands for years and years. But on the other hand, the Russians thought, you know, they would use these Central Asian troops, and these guys didn't, you know, they paid them and fed them and told them what to do, and they pretty much did it. I mean, it's not until late in the war that the Russians have big problems with desertions or anything like that. And then the revolution, I say late in the war, late in Russia's war in 1916 a little bit with the Brusilov offensive, and then more in 1917. But for the first couple of years of the war, under these murderous circumstances in which some Russian units went to battle with one rifle for 16 soldiers. I mean, the idea was when the guy with the rifle gets shot, then somebody else picks it up, and then when he gets shot, somebody else picks it up. But these people were, I mean, you got to realize that's a different kind of obedience. It's not necessarily a nationhood obedience. You know, they're all patriots or something. And indeed, if you think about it, all the studies of modern armies talk about, I mean, it's where the whole Band of Brothers thing comes from, and S.L.A. Marshall's studies of World War II, that these fighting units come from personal allegiance. I mean, the platoon fights together because they're all a band of brothers rather than because they're all Americans and standing up for America or whatever. And I think that could have been a part of it. But certainly these Central Asians and Finns and Poles and Ukrainians didn't feel like they were Russians much at all. Okay, more questions, anybody? I'm trying to see where all this combat engineering comes from on the other line, but I don't see the origins of that. Okay. Any more questions I have not covered? Okay. Well, I don't want to keep you, and we're about 5 minutes over time. If everybody's wait a minute, there may be another question here. There is. Erica asked this. There was a question early in the lecture. Why did Bismarck feel Germany needed to isolate France? Oh, so because otherwise Germany knew that Germany could beat France under any circumstances because they had trounced France in the Franco-Prussian War. So, but on the other hand, France was big enough and strong enough that with anybody else, any other power on her side, then she could, you see, beat Germany. So all she needed was not even a great ally, but at least one that would fight. In other words, if she got a good fighting ally that really had an army, I mean, I don't think she, Spain had fallen so low and was in the midst of all these wars and upheavals and things. I don't think Spain would have done any good. But a real fighting ally of some kind, and I think that France would have just, you know, that it would have been a done deal. So he just had to keep France without a real military ally, and so without making a defensive or offensive treaty, you know, in the provisions of it. Okay? Maybe that answers that question. And then Malcolm says, why was Bismarck so against France? Well, I mean, I don't think he was that much against France. He just knew that the French hated him because they had defeated him in 1871. They imposed a 5 billion gold franc indemnity on the country, and they took a big province, Alsace-Lorraine, where people, it's true, spoke German, but still that province had belonged to France. So he knew the French hated him. He didn't hate the French so much. In fact, Bismarck prided himself on not being, he was a practitioner of realpolitik, the politics of reality. It's just, he said, in politics you do what, you don't do what your passions say. You don't do what you don't get back at somebody unless that does you some good. You have to do what is the politics of being pragmatic and set, it's like billiards where you're setting yourself up for the next move. You never get mad. You never try to run the board. You're just working all the time for the future. So that's how, I don't think he hated France. He just wanted to keep France from breaking up Germany, which was France's plan. So, I mean, hope, anyway, not necessarily the plan, partly the plan. Here's another one from Carl Fielding. Did the papacy take an active role in the alliances at this time? No. The papacy was actually protected for a long time by the French. And so the moral suasion on the part of the Pope might have swung in the French direction. And there's some historical studies of this. I mean, it's a really interesting question, but I think the papacy was completely out of the alliance business. After World War I, the future Pope Pius, as a papal legate, was involved in some of the in some of the border decisions as just a member of the committee and a legate from the Pope. But in fact, in terms of these big power decisions, not really at all. The church was out of it. I hope that answers your question. Any more? Okay, good. Well, I say going once, going twice, and okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Hope you enjoyed it. Next week we start fighting the battles and looking at the home front and doing all those things. So I think we're ready to roll. Very good, very good. Glad to have you on board, every single one of you. Thank you so much, and I will see you next week.